Genesis chapter 14. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, these kings made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemeba, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. And all of these joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, and the Emim in Sheva Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran, on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En Mishphat, that is Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites, who were dwelling in Hazazon Tamar. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out, and they joined battle in the valley of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer king of Elam, Tidal king of Goim, Amraphel king of Shinar, and Arioch king of Elasar, 4 kings against 5. Now the valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, and as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them, and the rest fled to the hill country. So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah, and all their provisions, and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and Aner. These were the allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the possessions, and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, and the women and the people. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer, and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheva, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have lifted my hand to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich.' I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten, and the share of the men who went with me. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share." Genesis chapter 14 is a story that very much belongs within the world of the ancient Near East, a world of wars between kings, of kings outside of the land, dominating over small kingdoms within the land. And the forces involved are significant here. We have Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and Elam is the first son of Shem. Abram is described as the Hebrew within this chapter. He's associated with Eber, perhaps, the younger son of Shem. And so the older son of Shem, when associated with Elam, is displaced by a younger son of Shem, a son of Eber. This sort of event suggests a relationship with the broader theme of the older son being displaced by the younger son throughout the book of Genesis. Cain and Abel, Seth, Esau, Jacob, Ishmael, Isaac, Judah, Joseph, etc. And in all of these different occasions, we see a reversal of the natural birth order. And this might be another example of what's taking place. Now, the king of Elam, Chedorlaomer, is ruling over the people of Canaan with his allies, these other kings. And this would seem to be, in part, a fulfillment of the prophecy of Genesis chapter 9 concerning Canaan. "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be to his brethren. And blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." This is a situation where kings from Japheth and a king of Shem are ruling over Canaan. They're dominating the land. And here comes another descendant of Shem to liberate Canaan. and to act on behalf of the land of Canaan. This is the curse that we see in the story of Noah, and now it begins to play out as these families spread out across the land. It's a flowing out of families at this point. The families of the nations have divided up and they're playing out their different destinies. Lot and Abraham have divided, two nations going their own way, and later we'll see Moab and Ammon arising out of Lot. These are split destinations. Another thing to notice in this chapter is the way that the story of the kings is interrupted at various points with glosses upon the particular place names or the locations or kingdoms. It suggests this is updated for a later audience. The story of the kings and the victory over them at this point is serving a purpose that is not merely anachronistic. It's not really the reason why the names are updated. The names are updated in order to show Israel that their forefather Abraham has won the victory over the people within this land. He's playing out the destiny of his descendants beforehand. When the land of people like the Amalekites is mentioned, it is anachronistic. Amalek has not yet been born. But the point is that the land later associated with Amalek is conquered, and it's liberated by Abraham. And this is a sign of the possibility of Abraham's descendants doing the same thing. Genesis 14, then, is a conquest narrative. It is a narrative of Abraham going throughout the whole land, conquering a significant tract of territory. He pursues Chedorlaomer and his forces up to the north of Damascus. It's a significant territory that he's marked out by his victory. And as we've seen, Abraham has been building altars throughout the land, then walking throughout the land, and then having a certain area of the land being declared as his possession in the future, mapped out as the territory that God will give to him. And here we see taking possession of the land and guarding the people within it. He's progressively developing a deeper relationship with the land and its people as we go through these chapters. So we begin in chapter 12 of having an Exodus experience in the land of Egypt, going down into Egypt because of a famine, being protected there, being delivered with plagues, and then going into the land, wandering throughout the land, spying out the land, as it were, and now winning a victory within the land. He's going through the history of his descendants in important ways. He's already been in significant places like Shechem and Ai, where they failed to take possession of the land, and he's built altars in these places. He's playing out the history of Israel in advance. And so as Israel looked back at stories like this, they would see that their destiny has been foreshadowed, that there's nothing that they will face that Abraham has not faced before them. The kings of the nations, Chedorlaomer and his forces, drive the forces of the land, the Canaanites, down to the asphalt pits, but yet Abraham can defeat them. And if Abraham can do it, then they may be able to do it too, with the forces that dominate the land in their day. Lot's part in this story is important. He's the one, it would seem, at this point, that Abraham's descendants would be named in. But yet, in the previous chapter, we saw that Lot went his own way. In many respects, he seems like a bad penny. He's gone his own way, but maybe he can be won back. You can imagine Abraham having great hope here as he goes out to rescue Lot. Maybe Lot will have learnt his lesson. Maybe Lot will come back to him. One of the questions within this chapter is how Lot and Abraham will relate by the end of it, this episode. Are they going to relate to each other as brothers? Or is Lot going to return to the status of a son-like character, his brother's son who is adopted into his family and who will bear his destiny? These are important questions. And as the chapter moves on, we'll see that there is a fateful decision that arises. Abraham gathers together his forces. He has influence within the land, and it suggests, as we read this chapter, that he has real weight to him. He's someone who's acting very much like a king at this point, not just a priest building altars, but a judge figure, a figure with military might, someone with allies, someone who can muster military forces. He himself has forces of over 300 men, 318 men, and that number is significant. Why that number in particular? Well, it's the gematria of the name of Eliezer, who we meet in the following chapter. It's the number of his house-born servant. These are people who are born within his house, and they're representing Eliezer, his chief servant. Now, The fact that he can muster this many men suggests that he probably has about 2,000 or 3,000 people in his sheikdom. There's a significant number of people surrounding him, and all of these are people who can fight for him, who he can call upon to his aid. They're not just regular mercenaries. These are people who belong to his own house. So he's already acting as a sort of king on some scale. And Abraham now is going to move to a grander scale of operation. He's acting with the peoples of the land, with allies around him, and he's combating some early empires. Chedorlaomer and the Japhethite kings come against him, and he's someone who can stand for the land he's within and make a conquest within it. He does not take absolute possession of it, that's something that awaits later developments, but he's able to drive out the opponents, and he divides up his forces, attacks by night, and pursues the opponents north of Damascus. After he wins the victory, he meets with the king of Sodom and Melchizedek, the king of Salem, in the king's valley. Melchizedek, the king of Salem, brings out bread and wine. He is described as the priest of God Most High, and he brings out bread and wine. We're seeing here themes of priesthood and kingdom. Abraham, as he has already gone throughout the land, has built altars, sites of worship, etc., and he's developed allies, Mamre, Anna, Eshcol, other figures like that who have surrounded Abraham and allied themselves with him. And he is met here by Melchizedek, the king of Salem. This meeting is an interesting one. It occurs at a very significant point within the story that invites reflection. Abraham has been playing out the history of the future history of his nation. He's gone through the story of the Exodus. He's gone through the story of spying out the land, the conquest of the land. And now he meets this mysterious figure from Salem. And he treats this figure in a remarkable way. This figure blesses him, but he gives him a tithe of everything he possesses. And it would seem that this Melchizedek character is of more significance than he might originally appear to be. The fact that he appears at this juncture suggests that there's something more to him. If he is playing out the destiny of Israel, what or who does Melchizedek represent? That site will later be the site of Jerusalem, and he's met by the King of Righteousness, as Melchizedek's name suggests. So it's a very significant meeting. At the site of Jerusalem, meeting with this mysterious character, it might seem to be an anticipation of a sort of Davidic kingdom, but a Davidic kingship that also has priestly authority. And so it's not surprising that the book of Hebrews and other parts of later scripture would reflect upon this event and see within this event something that maybe augurs something greater in the future, some anticipation of what some figure might arise later on in Israel's history. And it's not surprising then that Christ is presented as the greater Melchizedek, the one who, after his victory over the principalities of powers, comes as the Davidic king from the New Jerusalem to his people with gifts of bread and wine, setting a table for them in the presence of their enemies, defeated enemies, feeding them at his feast. We are the true sons of Abraham. We're fed by the great Melchizedek. And so this pattern, as it plays out, anticipates later history and the destiny of the people of God. And the king of Sodom says something quite fateful at this point. He says, Abraham, you can keep the goods, but I want to keep the people for myself. And what does that mean? It means that the king of Sodom wants to keep Lot. He wants Lot and his family. And so all the people are returned to the king of Sodom. Abraham might have hoped that he would have Lot restored to him, but that is not to happen. He's been liberated from captivity to King Chedorlaomer, but he's now back within the land and has a part to play within the society of Sodom. He's pitched his tent near Sodom in the past, but later on we'll see him enter within their gates, being one of their rulers. He's one of the people who has influence within that society now. And so this story is one that is a pivotal point, a point where the destiny of Lot and Abraham separates more decisively. And whereas in the previous chapter it might have been just for a period of time, now it seems more definitive. One question. As we're reading the story of Abraham, it's important to keep in mind that there are a lot of moving pieces. There's Abraham's relationship with the land, there's Abraham's relationship with the people of the land, there's Abraham's relationship with his wife Sarai, there's Abraham's relationship with the promises of God. At this point, it would be good to step back and reflect upon how all these different aspects of the story stand at this particular juncture, to take stock of how things stand before the significant events of the chapter that follows.